with new stuff. So, particularly what I wanted to show you is how these messages interact with each other, and thus I think it's a good idea to have a look at an example. So, well, this is the example from the beginning, and the whole part of the lecture was motivated by the idea that in this example there is some odd behavior, and well, maybe now is the time to have a look at whether this is a thing that shows such an odd behavior or not. So, for this example, we have initial values for the variables. We all assume them to be zero. We suppose that A and B reside in different cache lines. This makes actual independent behavior of those two lines possible, but depending on how large the cache lines in your concrete systems are, this is a thing that needs to be, well, for purposes of showing that, you would need to pad the end, pad the memory until you reach the end of that particular cache line, for example, if you want to enforce that they reside in different cache lines. Otherwise, it's up to the actual compiler how to lay out its memory, of course. So, yeah, that is the cache lines thing. Yeah, so still what we would like to assume here is that the cache line is larger than the variable itself. This is kind of the main motivation why we need something like a read invalidate, because if the cache line is larger than an actual variable, it's important to first read the complete line and then modify just a bit in there. Otherwise, we could just plainly invalidate and start rewriting that. So that is the reason why there is a read invalidate. Yeah, well, in order then to model the state and the actual content of the cache lines, we use particular notation. I guess it comes pretty natural. It's the letters for the states, MES and I, and MES are states that can still carry values, so we continue with the actual value that is in there, which is, in our case, is just a numeric value in that sense. In practice, it would be a complete cache line, but, well, we said we're not interested in this thing here. We just assume that they reside in different cache lines and are padded. So, then can have a look at the example program from before. Starting from our initial states, well, we haven't given a particular pre-given values in the caches. So what we start from here is a situation where we have invalid for each of the cache lines for each of the processors. So there is representations of the cache lines for A and B in CPU A, and cache lines for A and B in CPU B. We indicate statements with some kind of abstract notation that we annotate as comments in these things, and then there's also the RAM over here that also carries information about A and B. So, it's probably a little bit of a, well, stretch to talk about instructions like these as basic instructions, since they are composed out of, well, micro instructions or assembly instructions, depending on the level that you look at, and in terms of memory interaction, they are decomposed into their components and executed separately from each other. So there's several effects that you see when executing, for example, this A1. And, well, if you insist on looking at these instructions on C or C++ level, then you might get arbitrarily complicated sequences of memory interactions depending on how complicated your expressions are. But that's just as a side note. So I think we can all, having introduction to hardware already in the first semester, I guess you can maybe live with that. So, What happens in instruction A1 is that A1 is a thing scheduled for CPU A, and we have determined that we start with we schedule A1 first. So what happens there is this wants to store a particular value into a variable. In order to do so, we look at the current representation of this address in our cache. For A, we see that we have no valid representation. So what needs to be done? Well, we said that there is a message that will trigger the delivery of that value to us, which would be the read message. Also, we already know that we don't really care about what we want to do with that. We want to immediately rewrite this value, so we do read invalidate even. So this is a thing that we issue on the common message bus. So read invalidate for address of A from CPU A is the message that is exchanged. And this triggers several other messages that can follow that. For example, one thing that is happening probably next is the answer from CPU B that answers with invalidate acknowledged. Because why? Well, CPU B has invalid as its state for variable A. So, invalidate acknowledgement doesn't cost you anything apart from a communication slot usage. Quite a long while later, the RAM will have looked up whether it has a value for this address or not, and will then issue the response to this read message. Yes, please. This thing here. So usually you have on a modern architecture, 64 bytes or something for a cache line. I don't actually remember. Pretty much at least, and it's probably larger than the space that you need for just this one little variable. So, in order to make a consistent update on this fraction of the memory, you need to retrieve the complete fraction of memory first, so that you still keep the rest of the cache line and not just A, and only replace the A part. So that's why you need the A. Okay? So that's the thing here. Good. So this will give the read response. The RAM usually doesn't deal with dropping cache lines and all that, so there is no invalidate acknowledgement to be expected from the RAM. This only comes from other CPUs, and we only have two CPUs in this system. So with invalidate acknowledged here, we kind of get all the acknowledgements that we needed. Then we also receive the read response from the RAM, which gives us the cache line in kind of exclusive state first, but we immediately at least from the communication point of view, just rewrite that particular part and go over into state M1. So this now depends on how detailed you model all the things that happen in your cache. You could also model another line in there where you say that this is exclusively so there's an intermediate thing in between where you say this is exclusively zero and all these things, for example, in between, but I leave it out here because it's immediately rewritten by the instruction over here and set to modified and one. So this then is the initial point for the next instruction, and let's say that meanwhile the scheduler has decided that thread B is executing, and it happens that thread B is now the one that is considered to be next, so we issue instruction B1, which is quite a complicated one. So we loop on the content of B0. So what happens there? For B1, CPU B is the one who needs to do something. So what will happen in there is we at some point will need to interfere with memory in form of a read of variable B. So for that, again, we look at our current local state of the cache, and looks like, well, for B we don't have anything. We still need to provide something to work with for the interpretation of that check. So what we do is we do a read message on the message bus, with the sender being CPU B concerning address B. And a long time, nothing will happen because the other cache also doesn't carry any information. But at some point in the end, we will get a read response with the appropriate response being zero, and this will lead to cache line for B going to exclusive. And, value is zero in that case, the one that comes from RAM. So this one goes there. Good. So then we will, during the interpretation of that, we will decide, well, B is actually zero, so the next instruction to look at will be, again, B1. And, well, we decide that, again, we want to actually really execute B1 and focus on what happens there. And, well, this now, before it actually checks, before it actually is interpreted, sees that there is a dependency on B. We check, oh, for B we already have something in our cache. And, well, for in that case, we don't need to bother the message bus with any message. Instead, we can locally answer this thing. And that is what the cache is for. This is the thing that speeds up your computation. We don't have to communicate with the RAM and wait for 100 cycles or so, but we can query the local cache, which is like 3 or 4, I don't know what, but it's like dimensions under the access time that ordinary RAM really has. So we check that. We only need to read from that, and we have it in exclusive state here, so we can locally just see what the value is, and this will, maybe it even loops for some time. I don't have it on here, but this could go on for some time. Eventually, though, we will have another go at CPU A with, well, A1 is already done, so we look at what A2 gives us. And this is, again, a store to of a value to a variable, and this will work in a similar way as it has for A1. First of all, this is a store, so we need to check whether we already have information about that cache line in order to make sure that we get the context right of that cache line. Turns out that for B, we don't have anything. It's an invalid line. So what we do there then is we issue read invalidate for concerning address B from CPU A, of course. So this is going to go to the bus, and the other actors will then have the chance to read that. And, well, thread B is pretty close to thread A, also can easily check the content of its cache quite speedily, in contrast to the main memory. So probably thread B will be the one who will be answering this one. And, well, what it will answer is two things. First of all, there had been the read component of the read invalidate, so it will give the read response to that. If you receive a read response for a cache line that you have, you usually then utter the response to that. If there are several other CPUs that issue this or have information about that line. Usually they compete about the message bus, and whoever wins will issue this message, and the others can also read from the bus, so will realize that this has already been answered and will then just shut up. Anyway, in our case, we have exclusively the information on that cache line, so a read response concerning that cache line, well, will lead us to assume that we are not the only ones who have the information about that cache line anymore. So what we will see is a change in the state of the CPU that issues the answer, as well as an effect on the state of the receiver of the answer. So we go from exclusive to shared on CPU B, and CPU A goes from invalid to shared with the value that is communicated on the bus. And, well, in principle, now thread A has information about that, but it's going to immediately modify that, and this has already been indicated with the invalidate part of the message on, over there, which still needs to be dealt with, and this is what CPU B still needs to do with an invalidate acknowledgement. And as soon as this arrives, we can modify the content of CPU A, all the invalidation messages that were expected have been received. And then there's also the effect on the content of CPU B's cache. It goes from shared to, well, we have acknowledged the invalidation of this cache line, so, well, better invalidate this cache line and drop information about that. So I think you can, with this sequence, already see a little bit in which direction this whole system goes. So with these protocols, you can make sure that these states are actually really consistent. Yes? Maybe back to this one.
So, okay, A tries to see if there's something in B, then B, CPU B notifies that there is actually something.
Mm-hmm.
So why does invalid date act then come from CPU B? I would have thought that A is now saying, okay, I now want to write a value, so please invalid date.
Oh. This is the acknowledgement only.
Ah.
This is kind of the answer.
Okay, yes.
This has been issued from here.
Yeah, okay.
Well, it kind of just is what you thought.
And the read response of B is equal to 0 from CPU B. It's basically a cache response. There is no RAM access involved.
In this one, there is no RAM involved. The RAM is actually... as soon as this read message is dropped on the bus, the RAM is starting to work. However, the RAM is slow. So you will pretty much never see the RAM actually answering this thing. So as soon as the RAM realizes that the read response concerning that address is already found on the bus, it will abort. So, yeah, that's how that should work. And even if the RAM would answer, then the CPU B should, in principle, see that this response has been issued to the bus, and in that, if it pays attention, it does. It should also set the value from E to S then. Okay, I guess.
Would it be possible to combine this read response with the invalidate acknowledgement?
I think, in theory, you could. In practice, I think it's not done. But I think it doesn't matter so much for our particular cases. I guess you could, probably. I don't know how... the bus also has some kind of limited size, so I don't know how much information you can encode into that thing, since particularly in the read response you also have to encode the actual content of the cache line that you are dealing with. So that particular message might be a little bit too stuffed for such information. But that is a little bit deeper than I bothered to actually look into. So, you were answering?
Is there a write-back scenario?
On this slide, no. On this slide, yes. So, there is... Well, when would you write back? You would write back as soon as you have information that has changed in your cache. And this only... Well, it happens over there. So, yeah, in principle, if by any chance your scheduler would say, oh, there's not a lot of traffic on the bus... Let's just take this opportunity and write our change for this thing back. That could happen. But that's an optimization that the hardware does that's beyond our scale. So this is could happen. We decide for that particular instance that it doesn't happen. And I think it also doesn't change a lot in the end. Okay. Good. So, well then. We continue with the scenario that we have seen. We have now modified both of the variables, A and B. And now we decide to focus again on instruction B1, since it's a loop and it's executed quite often. So we have said that for the loop, we need to know about value of B. So we need to check that. And first of all, we check whether we have information available. And we see, oh no, we have lost that due to some misfortune. So we need to read again. So that's what we do. We issue a read concerning address of B on the bus. And this will then, at some point, be registered by the other actors, particularly actor CPU A, who has information about the address of B, particularly it has a modified cache line for B. So this is what we find there. And if we receive a read message for a modified cache line, what we will do as well, usually we have to answer. So we propagate that information to the other cache and intend to go to shared state because we have propagated the value to another cache line. However, we can't do so because we couldn't differentiate between going from exclusive to shared from going to shared from modified. In order to be able to still go to modified, we need to make sure that the authority in this game, which is the main memory, is informed about an actual change that has happened. And that is why we now answer, and we answer with write back instead, instead of read response. This carries the cache line together with a message as payload and will be registered by the CPU B as well as the RAM or at least some kind of queuing system inside the RAM and the cache line itself. So the write-back leads to a lot of changes in here. So then, with that, we have information about B and can interpret this this instruction here. And this will then realize that, well, now B is actually zero, which means that we can leave this loop and, then fall through to our final instruction B2. And within B2, we will have to evaluate whether the value of A is equal to 1, which means this is a read from location of A. And, well, in that sense, this is what we will do. So B2 starts from this and will now start from this state over here, and I will try to read from A. And what that does is it checks whether there is local information about A. There is none, so we need to read cache line for address A. And this is again going to CPU A as well as the main memory. However, CPU A answers first, and it will answer with write back because it has the information in modified state, which will transition into shared state then. And as soon as that is read from CPU B, this will also be set to shared state, and well, the RAM will also flip over to 1 at some point. Yes, so that is everything that happens until we reach that particular part. And in that sense, we have also communicated the flipping this bit in A to thread B without problems, so we can't really observe some strange behavior with at least this choice of instructions to be observed. And well, with this messy protocol in play, you can try to play around a little bit with the actual sequences of instructions that you're gonna look at, but turns out that with messy protocol in your system and still having caches that that keep book of your cache lines separately for different CPUs, you will still ensure sequential consistency. So this assertion will always be true, at least for that example here. So yeah, I think this one. What is that? I think this is just another starting initial state thing, but I think it doesn't really give us anything right now. Yes?
Could you go back to the slide?
Mm-hmm.
In the second line, the write back comes from CPU A.
Yes.
Which is because just the cache of CPU A is faster than the RAM.
Yes.
But in theory, if we ignore the timing, then it could also come from the RAM, and then the value would be zero for B. So, in practice, do we rely on the timing of the cache to be faster than the RAM, or is there anything else involved?
That depends on the on how the hardware is implemented. I have not. I don't have any disclosed facts about how it actually really makes sure that this is happening before. Yeah, but in that sense, yes. But all that would keep CPU A from answering CPU B would be traffic on the bus, and since CPU B, well, can't continue, there's immediately a slot for that. I don't know how it is done in larger systems, but there might also be some strange hierarchies that just combine always two cores with each other. I don't know how they really do that on hardware. But you, in order for the SMASI protocol to really work, you would have to make sure that in case that there is a modified version, then that the RAM doesn't really answer. You could maybe do that by snooping for invalidate messages on the cache, and if there is one, then you could consider that the RAM is not allowed to answer that, for example. I don't know whether they do that, but that's just a quick idea to pursue. But it's actually really complicated to get insight into how real caches are working, and also they change around a lot during different generations of hardware development. So I can't say you for sure what's happening there, but that would be an idea of how to do that. Okay. But it's a valid question. For correctness, this needs to be not a timing-rated thing, but something that really makes sure that either by proving that timing at some point will be faster from the CPU than RAM, or, well, if you can't prove that, then you need to have some hardware facility that makes sure that you've done the answer before. Okay. Good. So, that is... So, since these kind of these diagrams here are kind of tedious to read and quite complicated because you have to pay attention to the address on which you which is concerned by this message and have to actually really read what the CPU is, we can also apply our idea of these sequence diagrams. So this would be the diagram that I want to focus on now. This is also a way of depicting the communication that happens on the message bus. The message bus is in that sense this white area in the middle where we have dependencies from one side to the other. So in these diagrams, we have several actors. We usually have two process lines that, in that sense, represent the threads that are communicating or the CPUs that are acting in these systems. They have caches, and we represent these caches independently for all the addresses that we are talking about. So we have cache lines for A and B for process A and A and B for process B on their respective CPUs. And these are the local caches of these things. If we would have to talk about things like main memory, which is not the case in this particular scenario, but if that would be the case, you would have to add another process line that would then say memory, for example. So, as you have seen, this particular piece of communication doesn't need interaction with the memory, so I didn't put a particular line in there. And, well, just for you to know in that sense. So, the communication between the actors here can be seen that there is, there's arrows that that are like, well, dependency edges between the events that happen there, and if they go from one CPU to the other, or from one CPU's cache to the other CPU's cache, then they have the names of the according messages. And what is still missing there is the actual states that the cache lines are in. And this is a thing that we still need to put on there. So in order for not having to design the complete diagrams here in our limited time, I have put the diagram already on there, but I still kept the states of the cache lines to be done live in that sense, because that's not so much work. So the important thing is what is the initial state of the whole thing. So this is what we are given. Oh, well, nice. What we are given here. So A has the information about B exclusively. So it has... Oh, that's not a good color. Exclusive 0 for B. And thread or processor B has information about A exclusively. So it's exclusive 0 for A here. And if it's exclusive, the respective cache content in the other peer is like invalid. So this is what is given initially. So then we can follow these diagrams like here, where CPU A executes the store to A, and this will first of all go to the cache line and check whether what the state of the cache line is. It realizes this is invalid, so we need to issue a read invalidate message on the bus, and turns out that cache B has information about that, so this will reach the other cache line. So this is the event here that's, that triggers some modifications to the cache line here. For example, here we will lose the exclusive state and go to shared zero. It's just quite compact here, so this is between those two events. Then after the read response, of course, after the read response, we are in shared zero. Before, well, it doesn't make sense. So as soon as we trigger this this message, we consider the value to be shared. This then arrives there, where we consider to have value as zero, value zero in shared state, and then at some point, CPU B will answer with invalidate acknowledged, and this will then mean that it has to drop information on A, and as soon as this arrives at CPU A, this will be exclusive, and in the same instance, then if we depends on whether we model that as two different events or not. If we don't model it as different events, then we will immediately go to modified one. And if as soon as that is done, the event of this instruction being finished is triggered, and from that there on we can then continue with something else. And just in this sequence, turns out that we have said that we want to now focus on the check in thread B, whether the value of B is zero, and this will then first consider this thing, which is invalid, so we have to read. This will make the state transition to shared zero there, which will also be transported there. So we have shared zero at the end of this read response, so we can terminate that in the end and have realized that this is still zero. This will then be iterated on until something changes, and as long as we have shared there locally, we don't need to reconsider, so the state remains there. And this, at some point, we CPU A will then again be executed. This will want to store a value in address of B. So what it will check is whether it has information about B already, and it turns out it has. It's in shared state, so what we will want to do is we will want to issue an invalidate message. So this is issued here and will at some point reach the other CPUs B, where it is invalidated, sent back, which will go to immediately exclusive and then immediately rewritten to modified one. So we will then continue another time, another go at the check whether B is zero. So this is invalid here, so we need to issue read. And since this is a modified thing, we will then go to shared, but answer with write back. So this is shared then also. And this is also where kind of the modeling with simple arrows reaches its limits, because this write back is now target or read from several instances. So if we would have designed the memory in this abstraction like this, we could, for example, just to keep to this notation of arrows, we would have to insert right back to the main memory also. But for purposes of keeping it short, I have not included the cache, the main memory on there. So I'll leave it away here, just for you to know. So then with that, we can evaluate this thing. This then falls through to the next instruction, and then we'll want to read everything about that here. So this will also go to shared and will terminate. So you see, this is like you also have to put a few cache dates on there, and every time that there's a change, you have to renew the actual state. And in case you're interested in the actual value of the state of the line, you go back to the most recent event that changed anything and can read the current state from that. So that's the way that you have to deal with these things. So, yeah. That's just observations on the way. So, we have seen now how MESI works in one particular instance here, and turns out that the way, if we have no further changes in how our hardware model underneath works, then MESI is sufficient to establish sequential consistency. And this means that although we have optimizations in access time for certain variables, we still have kind of well-behaved programs which we can understand and use quite stable. But still, we have actually quite a complex hardware model that we can deal with now, which allows for diversification of access speeds, and thus gives a lot of room for optimizations. Yeah. So, however, is that already the end of the whole story? Well, there's other things that are out there, motivated by further hardware optimizations that are actually possible. So let's have a look at what is out there. So one change to the whole thing is out of order stores. And what does that mean? Well, there's one particular thing that makes execution a little bit tedious. Particularly, one thing is, well, every time that you write to some memory address, what you will have to do is, well, for example, look at this right here. What you will have to do is you will have to wait for an actual invalidate acknowledgement to arrive. So it's the same issue here. You also have to wait for invalidate acknowledgement. This, at the first glance, looks quite nice, but as soon as you, or not as bad as it could be, but as soon as you extend this model to more and more actors in there, so if you have, for example, like 8 cores in your notebook already, I don't know, 12 cores on your desktop PC, or like 48 cores on your developer server or anything, you can imagine that each time writing to a particular cache-based memory address will mean that you will have to collect 7 invalidate acknowledgements, 47 invalidate acknowledgements. That's a thing that soon won't scale particularly well anymore. So with the desire to pack more and more cores onto your machine, the desire for not having to wait for invalidated acknowledgements is quite high. So, what could you do in that sense? Well, you could say, well, maybe what happens if I already look at what the next instruction does and just start executing with the thing that comes after the store? And with that, you are already in the area of these out of order stores. And yeah, let's have a look at what the consequences of that is. So far we have had these very simplistic modelings where the main memory is just one actor in the system. We have split that up into actors for each of the addresses. We have split that up even further into actors for cache lines and their respective representations of the variables, which already have introduced a lot of actors in the system. Now, what we get when we start with out-of-order execution of stores, we will, well, there's several ideas of how to represent that in actual real hardware memories, hardware architectures. However, what the actual way that this is implemented, looks like is not particularly relevant as long as it has a similar behavior as a particular standard. And the way that the standard for this particular idea of semantics is to specify an abstract machine model that talks about the concept of store buffers. And this is kind of one way to explain how certain semantics work. And as long as the original hardware, it doesn't necessarily need to have a store buffer in the form as it is in this diagram, but as long as it keeps its behavior as if it would have such a store buffer, then it still is a valid implementation of that particular abstract machine model. So that's why we, in that sense, don't talk about the concrete implementation of that thing, but about this abstract model of how caches work, because this is the way that the standard can be defined in that sense. You will, by the way, have a hard time of finding such a thing in the actual instruction manual of concrete hardware architectures. The way that they try to define how the behavior is actually by just giving behavioral examples. And people have been wondering whether there has been work beforehand that had some kind of clear idea of how the semantics of certain things have been in the first place, whether people have started to just drop a few preconditions now and then came up with an appropriate model afterwards. So it's not clear. Development of these kinds of hardware is, well, like a black box. So anyhow, the way that this level of freedom of rearranging stores is defined or can be defined is with this particular model of store buffers. So what's that all about? Well, we have seen that there is a stack of hardware working for each of the CPUs to support it, in the sense that we have these pillars here representing each of the CPUs. So these are each of these pillars is like a stack of support hardware that feeds into the actual CPU itself. So there's a CPU there, and this the CPU is fed with information copied from the main memory into the actual cache. So these are the components that we have seen already. What is new in this model here now is that stores to particular addresses don't go directly into the cache anymore, but instead are kept into a buffer, so that what the CPU has to do is not communicate directly with the cache and wait until all the acknowledgements have arrived, but instead what it does is it immediately it writes them into the store buffer, and as long as the store buffer has slot free for that thing, the CPU can still continue its work, and the store buffer independently from the CPU will make sure that at some point its modifications are communicated to all the other actors and then are found in the actual cache. So, then, in terms of abstract machine model, each store is put into a store buffer, and execution is continued. Loads are still taken directly from the cache, so there is no optimization done there. What the store buffer does now is, well, as long as you just keep talking about the store buffer, not fixed. Instead, you need to specify what the store buffer actually really is. And although the name suggests that the buffer is something like a first-in, first-out data structure, well, life would be too easy if everyone would keep the conventions, wouldn't it? Well, there are certain implementations of store buffers that are FIFO and certain that are not FIFO, but have kind of random access. That's the way that I feel too. That's not so particularly nice, but they contribute to different memory models. So the first-in, first-out store buffer leads to the TSO model, which is, well, quite prominent because it's, well, a lot of major architectures have TSO implemented, like, well, in theory at least, Intel x86. Some Spark architectures also have that, and well, a lot of others have this thing. But well, users beware. There is certain fractions of the x86 instruction set that is not having TSO, but instead something weaker than that. But that is hidden somewhere in the SSE extensions. So. Yeah. Actually, I don't want to. This is why it's so ugly to talk about practical implementations. They seem to drop their preconditions at some point and do just what they want at some point. So, yeah. Anyway, for the most part, x86 architecture has the TSO model, which means that they follow a model where the store buffer is a FIFO buffer. Yeah. And, well, a thing that you might find important to highlight is the thing that you see here. This is talking about the way that a CPU perceives its own state. And this is a thing which is quite important in order to somehow reason about what your current thread is seeing as the machine state. And it turns out that it's quite a good thing to have a concept like program order, which means that if you have certain events like stores or loads that occur in your local thread, that at least your local CPU sees these events in the order that the program is actually specifying. This is not a given. There are situations where this is not given, but yeah, at least for the purposes of this particular memory model, this is a thing that is desirable to be maintained. And in order to do so, what is happening is that there that if you put a particular update into the cache and finally in the main memory, this usually goes into the store. I've said that loads usually consider the cache directly. However, if you, for example, try to load a thing that that you have stored immediately before into the store buffer, this has not been communicated to the cache. So in order for your local CPU to still reflect that there has been a store happening, there is some interconnection in between. this node here, so to say. This means that the store buffer snoops at what communication is going on between the cache and the CPU, and if the CPU wants to know something about an address where we have an entry in the store buffer, it will interject and answer directly to the CPU. So in that sense, the CPU gets the desirable program order, because every update that has been communicated to the store buffer will then flow back as soon as it's read again. However, the rest of the system might be not informed about that particular update and will not perceive the changes that your CPU does in the same order as you do. Anyway, so what is the model that is coming from that? And well, this is just another way of specifying the things that you have seen here as a drawing, which is a formal definition of the TSO model. You will have a hard time trying to find a formal definition of how the TSO model works in like mainstream architectures anymore, and this is exactly the reason why I have put this kind of ancient architecture spark in the brackets here, because this is the only instruction manual where I have found something even remotely close to a formal specification of how a memory model really works. And apart from that, you would have to decipher the way that memory works from kind of 30 different examples of instruction sequences and possible outcomes of that. And I guess having just four lines of formulas to interpret is a lot quicker than having a go at 30 examples and trying to replicate in your mind what's going on the machine. So formal model would have been highly desirable, at least from my point of view, but yeah, you have to really look for that. And well, you have to go back to the year 1992 in the Spark instruction manual to get something like that. But that's the way it is. So, TSO model. This is the model that comes from the store buffer being a FIFO buffer. It's meant to read as total store order, and what it features is several things in there. So there is the concept of the so-called memory order here, which is this comparator operator, and this is meant to represent the way that the accesses on the main memory are sequentialized. So in the TSO model, what is given is that the store order with respect to the memory is meant to be a total order. What does that mean? Well, it does mean that between each and every store of each and every machine to each and every address, if it has happened, you can find a place in the sequence of all the memory access where this is correctly placed. So there is an actual order between all the stores that are happening between all the processors. So there is either if you talk about two stores to different addresses, potentially different machines I and J, then either one is happening, store one is happening before store two, or store two is happening before store one. But there is at least they are ordered in some way at least. So that means that you can find a linearization of these things. Then the next component that is there is the program order. This is one that we have already talked about. This is set up by the actual way that your local algorithm is set up. So this defines the program order. And this is with this green comparator in there. And what the second part of the definition of TSO says is that if stores are ordered by program order, then this order is reflected in the memory order as well. So if you find that a store to A is happening before a store to B in program order, which means that the index of the CPU needs to be the same. If they are ordered locally, then you will find that they are also ordered in the global view that comes from the memory. And this doesn't mean that there is no other thing that is interjected in this sequence. So there could be arbitrary others in between, but just between those two, the order of the program is retained. Then, next thing that's given, loads preceding another operation in program order are also in, found in that order in the memory order. So a load before any operation is also found in the memory order if it is in program order. Okay, so far so nice. Then there's the fourth thing that tells us about what the actual value of load should turn out to be. And this is formulated that way. There's this value function that tells you we are reasoning about actual values. So the value that is then perceived as the value of a particular load instruction for processor I concerning address A is given by the value that was stored. And, well, this now is a is given as the maximum function of, well, with respective to the memory order. So the most recent store that the memory has observed, and which are the candidates for that? Well, those candidates are given by the memory order of all those stores that happened before the load in question. So this load is the load that we are actually talking about. So all the stores that are in memory order before that load are candidates for the value that the load will return, but we have a maximum function on the program order, which means the most recent store that still is happening before the load. So this is kind of like a natural way of saying that, well, the last store to this variable, no matter which processor issued that, will be the one that answers this load. But, and then there's a second component. The other ones that you look at is also the ones that are determined by what your program order says with respect to stores that happen most recently and still happened before the load. So here we just look at local stores that happened before this load thing here. So yeah, the depending on which of the stores, either the ones that come from the memory ordering or the ones that come from the program ordering, are happening more recently with respect to the program order, those are the ones that are actually responsible for telling about the value of a particular thing. So this is kind of the way of encoding by formula the property that you have this store buffer interjecting in the actual communication with the memory subsystem and answering questions in case that the in case that there is an actual entry in there, which means that there would be possibly a store that isn't contained in the stores over there. Anyway, apart from that, what is the thing that differentiates this TSO model now from this, the MESI models on just cash systems without store buffers? Well, one ordering property is now dropped. And this is the one that I've explicitly given you here, because that is the one that creates trouble for sequential consistency. So what is not guaranteed anymore is that if you observe in program order that a store to address A happened before a load from address B locally, that's why we have program order here and the same index for store and load. This does not guarantee anymore that we find this reflected in the global view of our memory interactions. So this store is not guaranteed to be perceived happening before the load on the actual memory. So local stores may be observed earlier by local loads than by loads from somewhere else. Well, that's probably pretty clear because they are stuck in the store buffer for some time. So if there is kind of a race condition by some other process reading a value that is still stuck in your store buffer and has not been communicated with all the other caches, then there might be a seemingly outdated value communicated to other loads, and thus there is some kind of trouble with sequential consistency. So what is the effect of such a thing? Well, what can happen for TSO, for example, is what you see sketched here in this example. So what we have here is a thread A and a thread B, and in thread A we set A to 1 and print B. In thread B, we set B to 1 and print A. So you might set your bets on what is a possible outcome for such a thing. We can do that locally. I think there's a lot of different outcomes there, and you can check whether the one that you will get here is among those that you have done on your sheet. However, let's have a look at what happens inside this particular example. So there's a lot of different outcomes of that thing. However, let's have a look at one particular. So there is one where we say A contains for a start shared value 0 for A and B. So this is shared 0, shared 0. B also contains shared 0, shared 0. So this is kind of an easy starter. So what happens then is that we look at A is filled with 1. This now goes into the store buffer instead of the cache directly. So the store buffer is, in that sense, some kind of FIFO list that contains A should be 1 now instead of 0. So A is 1 goes into that list. And nobody forces the store buffer to immediately work. So this might still keep this information around for a little bit. Particularly, what is allowed to happen is that the processor doesn't need to wait for completion of this store. Instead, it can immediately start working on the next instruction, which would be a read from B. So this thing would, well, probably first, well, will go out through this connection to the cache for reading, and since there's no information on B in the store buffer, then this directly goes through to the cache line, where we find that B is 0 here. Nice. So at the same time, we have the CPU B acting here, like storing B is now 1 in its store buffer, and also this thing is lazy and doesn't want to communicate its information to the rest, so it will do next instruction, which is a read of A, which goes unbothered into the cache line A, which responds 0, so this will also respond 0. And then all of a sudden there's a lot of idle time on the message bus, so at some point the store buffers decide to now really act, and well, that's what they do here now. So this will realize that in order to write its value into the actual cache, it will need to invalidate this cache line. So this talks to the cache line over there, which will need to go from shared to invalid. And over here we have now exclusively 0, which will then immediately go to modified 1. And same is done over here, where we do invalidate and then go to modified 1. So in the end, the memory contains the correct values, and our output contains like 0, 0. It's not necessarily the case. It's just this particular sequence of instructions that is for that particular execution that triggers this behavior. So if you let an example like this run for some time, you might obtain the results that you think you should obtain in sequentially consistent systems for like 13,000 times. And 13,000 first time, you will see that, oh, I also get a result like print 0, 0. So, yeah, this is, and you see that there's not a lot of complicated algorithms necessary to perceive this. This is just subsequent stores and reads that can lead to this odd behavior. So, TSO is occurring out there in the wild in x86 systems. So this is a behavior that you might observe out there, depending on the initialization of your cache lines and the history of what you have executed so far, is what is giving you the initial content of your cache lines. And yeah, what you can take from that is that the thing that you need to take care of is everything works as you would expect in sequential consistency on TSO systems, and thus particularly on your personal laptop and whatever device you're looking at right now, apart from this stores in program order that might be seen differently from other CPUs, which will make life complicated in case that you communicate via raw memory in and out between those two things and just try to busily wait on some bit flipping or something. So in order to still provide meaningful parallel or concurrent computations on these things that still support these kind of protocol communications, there is things that you can do there. Particularly on the x86 architecture, there's a concept that's called the MFENCE instruction, which is a memory barrier in that sense. So if you put that between two operations in your local in your local program, this will mean that the system will issue such an MFENCE instruction, which will lead to introducing actual memory ordering between the operations that are to the left of the MFENCE and the operations to the right of the MFENCE. So this is kind of a hard coding of the actual of the program order to directly appear in the memory order. So this will kind of make sure that although in theory these things could happen, if you put an M fence between those, you will still get the ordering that you desire. So this gives you, if you use that in all the spots where you potentially read one variable in one CPU that is written to by another CPU, this will make your CPU still sequentially consistent. However, this means also that the CPU will have to empty out its store buffer before it can continue, and for that to work, you will have a lot of traffic on the cache in order to collect all the invalidate acknowledgements and then be able to write to the actual cache lines. So this is what is the consequence of that. So what you could do is you could, in order to make your ordinary desktop PC sequentially consistent, you can put memory fences between each and every instruction. However, this will mean that you will work on a machine that has the same speed as one that doesn't have a store buffer. And this can drastically reduce the performance of your system. So you usually use fences only when necessary. So there are still other memory models that are even weaker, which means that they drop a lot of the guarantees that are still in the system. But due to the time here, I think we are better off when we have enough time to concentrate on the particular features. So there's still the PSO model, there's still relaxed memory ordering, and, well, I think it would be a good idea to continue next time, but that's the thing that you can expect from next Wednesday. So thank you for your attention, and have a nice week, and I see you.